On this week's 51%, we speak with filmmaker Barbara Koppel about her current works and one from decades ago.
And it, you know, also gave me a lot of self-confidence because people told me I couldn't do it, and I knew I could.
Hear wistful words about a lesbian bar up for sale, and learn about carving spoons in a woman's wood shop. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I'm just a girl who can't say no. I'm in a terrible fix. I always say, come on, let's go, just when I ought to say nix. When a person tries to...
In her documentary, A Murder in Mansfield, Barbara Koppel explores the legacy of the 1989 murder of Noreen Boyle in Mansfield, Ohio. Boyle's 12-year-old son, Collier, had delivered testimony blaming his father for the murder. Now, more than two decades later, Collier Boyle returns to Ohio seeking to retrace his past and confront his imprisoned father, who remains in denial of his guilt. It is a film about human resilience. Koppel, a two-time Academy Award-winning filmmaker for Harlan County, USA, about a violent miner strike, and American Dream, about a strike at Food Corporation Hormel, is producer and director of A Murder in Mansfield. I caught up with her at the film screening at the Woodstock Film Festival in the fall, and first asked to what she attributes being a prolific filmmaker.
Well, I would not call myself prolific. I think that I just love the work that I do. I really like understanding who people are and what they're about and can't stop myself. I guess I'm a girl that can't say no.
Speaking of girls and women, how has filmmaking changed, you think, in terms of women filmmakers? Has access changed? Has perception changed? Is it a different documentary versus, you know, a narrative feature?
Yeah, I think that a lot has changed because at the very beginning, if you were a documentary filmmaker, nobody cared. Nobody cared if you failed or you succeeded, or they'd say, why does a little girl like you want to do a film like this? And so you didn't have that kind of pressure on you. You could just go out there and do the work that you needed to do. And I think as of late, because we have so much cable and they need so much content, that we're able to do more and more work. And people want to be able to hear stories and get a sense of truthfulness.
But what about as a woman? I mean, you're well known. Your documentaries are well known. You can't say that about a number of female documentarians. Is there something with access? Is there something to establishing a name for yourself, which is probably not gender oriented, in getting these films made?
It's a hard question. I think that people are of late calling me up and saying, how would you like to do a film on this or that? And always before, I wanted to do a film and would have to go and would have to beg for money to be able to do it. So that's the change, that the funding is there, the studio or Netflix or, you know, HBO clearly wants that film done. So they're just asking me if I'd be interested in it. That's the change.
And that's because you're Barbara Koppel, not because you're a woman. That's because you're an established filmmaker with a proven record.
Well, I think that it's because they figure the particular topic is something that I would deal with love and tenderness and, you know, really struggle to try to find out what's happening. So it would be a film that maybe I could do well.
Do you think that that is essentially female then, that kind of approach? Is a male, I don't mean to sound so generic, but is a male capable of the kind of compassion? Of course a male is capable. It's a terrible question. Let me backtrack.
Well, you're going to get someone extra for Hart Perry, who's a director and a cinematographer, and he's done many films. Do you want to talk to that at all?
It's a good question.
I'm so sorry, but I think you know what I'm trying to drive at, that I'm not trying to demonize men.
No, but I have an answer for that.
then I'm going to crawl over for it.
When I was shooting Harlan County with Barbara, mm-hmm. Barbara did something which, as a man, I thought was really interesting. She decided to spend a lot of time filming with a women's support group. And it turned out that they were much more articulate than the union male miners. With the guys' meetings, not that much happened. But with the women, it really gave an insight into the emotional dynamics of the strike. My favorite was when Lois took out the 38 pistol from her bra.
So, and this wouldn't have happened, obviously, if Barbara weren't on set saying, speaking about how to put this film together and say we really should reach
exactly.
out to the support group, and this is going to add this dimension to this film that's probably needed. And you never know what you're going to get, right, when you turn the camera on, so could end up on the editing floor, but it didn't.
Well, it became central because
right.
we recorded every meeting of the women's support group.
Advice for women filmmakers.
Advice for women filmmakers is that you should go after what you really care about and what you're passionate about, and there'll be people there always to help you.
Wow. You know, sometimes when I ask this question, I get there's always be people to knock you down, and you have to fight. So I really appreciate your answer for this. What films are left to be made for you? What are you really wanting to get your hands on?
There's so many. There's one film that I'd really love to do. It's a friend of mine. His name is Dennis Watlington. And he was the first black man to go to Hotchkiss in the 60s and 70s. And he just wrote a beautiful piece about his life and growing up and robbery and going to jail and going to the South and being discriminated against and then coming back and writing a play called Bullpen and getting away from gangs and anger. And I really have always wanted to do a film about this.
We look at the times we're in now, and I guess you could say this of almost any era, right? We're always in some sort of time with just something conflicting happening. But right now, it just seems heightened. It just seems more, I don't know, it's just a horrible time. But it could also be a great time, what comes after this. Do you see this as like, well, I really need to make something about something within this time now. There's a connection that needs to be formed and brought to the screen now.
Well, I'm doing a film on civil rights now, and I'm doing it from a very different angle. It's two different families that were always very poor, a black family and a Latino family. And every single one of the kids in the Latino family and in the black family are doing extraordinary things with their lives. And so I'm following two of them.
Because you make documentaries, you have this window into our society, and you have it over the decades through the biography films you've done, through strike films, through others, through something like this, and you really get a window into a wide variety of lives that are snapshots of this country. What is your comment on what's going on in this country? I mean, do you have optimism? Or are you just, you know, when you think about this and you review kind of in your mind the real, so to speak, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking that we as filmmakers, you as a journalist, have to keep doing our work and have to keep getting out there and talking to people and showing who they are. And that's the way that is the easiest and the most proactive for me.
Reviewing your films, is there one that is kind of comes to the front of your mind now that maybe at the time, you know, it's like, okay, that was great. I'm glad I did that. And, you know, people really liked it. But just in reflection, upon reflection, you think, you know, that was a really important film.
Well, I think probably for me, Harlan County, USA was the most important film. It taught me what life and death was all about. It taught me about what people were willing to stand up for what they believed in. And it, you know, also gave me a lot of self-confidence because people told me I couldn't do it, and I knew I could.
Anything else about the state of women in filmmaking? I mean, anything?
I think that women are in great solidarity with each other. we help each other, we have a tight bond, we want each other to succeed, we look at each other's films, and anytime a woman breaks through, it's good for all of us.
That was filmmaker Barbara Koppel at the Woodstock Film Festival, where she attended the screening of her documentary, A Murder in Mansfield. An historic lesbian bar on Cape Cod is up for sale. It opened in 1955, serving women who made the pilgrimage to Provincetown. Reporter Monique Laborde went on a journey of her own to get the story of the Cape's last lesbian bar. And just to note that there are sexual descriptions in the piece.
At some point in my coming out process, I started dreaming about the gay havens. San Francisco, the West Village, and Provincetown. The small fishing village at the tip of Cape Cod. Covered in the footprints of icons. Mary Oliver, Tennessee Williams, Alison Bechtel. Thousands of queer people have driven the long road to Provincetown. All of us hoping to escape the straight world. For a night, a weekend, or a lifetime. Mae Bush drove from New Bedford in 1957. Misty Baldwin from Washington, D.C. Jesse Mucci rode a motorcycle from Connecticut, guided by a paper map, and arrived in Provincetown in the middle of the night. When they drove over the hill on Route 6 and saw Provincetown, they got chills.
Came over the hill and saw the monument and the...
And the dunes on the right-hand side. It was thrilling.
That excitement. I'm like, oh my God, that's Provincetown.
It's the end of the road, you know. The next stop is England.
Fishermen were walking around with their yellow slickers and their yellow outfits and their boots, carrying baskets, you know, like they might have a basket of fish under their arms.
I was told that the town was predominantly lesbian. And it was. Nobody was calling you queer. You didn't have to worry about walking down the street and get your ass whooped or for a woman get raped because they could show you. You didn't have to deal with all that. You could just go down the street holding your girlfriend's hand and no reprisal. They came from every corner of the earth to be here, to be women, to be lovers, to be out, every corner of the earth. Because the world we knew out there was not a safe place.
These women who came to Provincetown in the 50s, 60s, and 70s all describe it to me the same way. Another world. One woman told me being in Provincetown back then was like stepping into a time machine. Into a future where gay men and women were out, walking on the streets, holding hands, laughing. And all these women found their way to a little bar on Commercial Street.
It's called the Ace of Spades.
The only women's bar.
And it was known everywhere that this is where you went.
The Ace of Spades Club opened in 1955. The original owners didn't know why women claimed their bar, but they didn't fight it. It was a blacksmith shop turned bar. Not so much a nightclub as a clubhouse.
The floors are like this, rolling. They were so old, they were warped.
And it had all kinds of brick-brack around, nautical BS.
In Massachusetts at the time, women had to be sitting down to be served alcohol, so they filled the bar with barrels that doubled as makeshift stools. Unlike lesbian bars in Boston or New York, which were dive bars in bad parts of town, at the Ace of Spades, women could be outside, overlooking Provincetown's harbor.
All you smelt was the sea air.
Seeing this, the harbor lights and the pier lights and a full moon. This is not BS. This is real. I'm telling you.
Provincetown's seasonal population swelled in the 60s. While Pam Genervino was visiting, she saw a business opportunity. She took over the Ace of Spades. And after only a few months, she got a call in the middle of the night. The bar had burned down. So she rebuilt, made it bigger, and gave it a new name, the Pied Piper, a place for women like her.
Well, you know, lesbians love to have sex. You understand that, don't you? They would go to the bathrooms. One of them would be sitting on the sink. And in the meantime, the sink fell off the wall. And of course, I had to close up that bathroom, shut off all the pipes and so forth, the water. Otherwise, the place would be flooded. So I took broom sticks and stuck them in the holes underneath these you know, sink so that they could sit on them, have sex, and not break my sink.
She ran a tight ship, Pam.
Pam was just in time for the 70s. 70s nights at the Pied Piper sound mythic.
You know, we had 1,500 women in there every day. It was full. We had security people. One would go out, one could come in.
I started going to lesbian bars a few years ago. I've never seen a crowd like that. Not in New York, not in North Carolina, not on a Saturday night, not ever.
There used to be a line around the corner 7 nights a week at the Pie. Disco music? Oh my God, yes. Nirvana. Wall-to-wall women cruising and making out feverishly. I mean, everywhere, every corner, on the deck, sometimes under the deck. You could do this. I mean, can you imagine in that day that you could be sexually free?
It's the highest natural high I've ever experienced, being at the Pied in those early days.
But the Pied Piper wasn't just for dancing and hooking up. Women of all ages went there to have a place of their own, unwatched by men. There have been weddings and memorial services on the deck of the bar. But in the late 90s, all that started to change. Women stopped coming to the bar as often.
People still straggle into the Pied looking for the Pied or looking for the past experience of the Pied or what they heard about the Pied, but there isn't.
All that's, it's gone now.
It's changed. It's changed.
I've heard many theories about why the bar declined. Some tired ones about the dawn of online dating, about how lesbians don't like to go out or can't afford to. Some locals told me they're frustrated by how the bar is being run. I reached out to the owner many times, but she didn't want to talk. Right now, the Pied Bar is up for sale, but most women I talk to refer to the bar in the past tense, as if it's already gone. Next year, it could be a restaurant, a private home, or another kind of bar. There are multiple bars for gay guys in Provincetown, and there are a few mixed bars, too. Just not any lesbian bars.
Women come here, and all they would say is, where's the women's bar? And I would say, no one. And they were like, are you kidding me? We come all this way, a gay town, and there's no women's bar? Heartbreaking.
It's not just Provincetown. In the past decade, the last lesbian bars have closed in New Orleans, Philadelphia, and San Francisco. The most common diagnosis for the death of the lesbian bar is this.
It was the only safe place. Whereas now there's a lot of them.
Gay progress killed the gay bar, even in a gay place like Provincetown.
If I said to Lynette today, you know, want to go for a drink and see who's around, I don't know where we'd go. Where would we go?
Where do you go?
Where do you go?
I came to Provincetown for the first time this year. At 23, I drove over the hill on Route 6, and I felt that chill. I strolled Commercial Street on a busy September day until I got to the entrance of the Pied Bar. I was eager for something that doesn't exist anymore. The bar was closed for the season. The doors were locked. Sometimes I find myself wishing I could go back in time, to the Pied. But nostalgia deceives me. I want that community, like there was at the old Pied Piper. But I don't want to go back in time to get it. In Provincetown, Massachusetts, I'm Monique Laborde.
Two Austrian women are the first same-sex couple to officially tie the knot in the predominantly Catholic country, following years of legal challenges from gay rights groups. Public broadcaster ORF reported that just after the new year, the two women wed in a ceremony in Velden, southern Austria. The couple, both 37, had reportedly been engaged for 4 years. Austria's constitutional court ruled in 2017 that same-sex couples should have the right to marry from January 1, 2019. Previously, same-sex couples could only enter into a registered partnership that granted fewer rights than marriage. Austria's current governing parties, the People's Party and the Freedom Party, had strongly opposed granting same-sex couples the right to marry, but said they would respect the court's ruling. Jess Hirsch visited Sweden to learn how to carve spoons. Now she's an advocate of Slug Sloyd, an artistic technique favoring axes and saws over power tools. KFAI's Angela Lundberg reports.
In a tiny woodworking shop in South Minneapolis, I'm Angela Lundberg. So spoons are these incredible utilitarian objects that are maybe the most intimate things we have in our house because we put them in our mouths. Jess Hirsch is swinging a heavy axe in front of five women. All right, so I still have a little more material over here for end grain. So I'm going to lob that off. The women are students, and they're here to learn how to swing their own axes and carve spoons for the first time. Hirsch is their teacher. She's a petite blonde in her early 30s who has no problem throwing down an axe. She's the founder of Women's Woodshop. I like to describe Women's Woodshop as my starter home. Mostly we offer classes to women and gender nonconforming folks. Hirsch started out as a sculptor. She got into the craft world on a total whim, and it all began with a spoon. It started with a very ugly basswood spoon that was 2 feet long and had a massive bowl, and I burned it. But it did start there. A main inspiration for Hirsch is an old Scandinavian tradition of woodworking called slöjd. In Swedish, slöjd means sleight of hand, skilled, or crafty. It's a technique and philosophy that require carving with fresh-cut wood and hand tools. No power tools allowed. Hirsch learned more about slöjd on a recent trip. When I was in Sweden, I was working with a number of different woodworkers and asking them what they thought slöjd was. And my favorite definition was slug slöjd, which would be clever slöjd, which... It's just seeing what's around you and imagining what you can make out of that using the simplest means possible. So it's really, it's about being sly as you are a woodworker. Hirsch notices an upsurge in people wanting to learn and do slöjd work. I think it connects us to the landscape in a way that other types of woodworking doesn't. A lot of people do this through farming and gardening. But when you're working in a city and you have an apartment, it's a lot harder to grow food and get your hands in the soil, but you can get your hands dirty with working with wood. But let's get back to those slöjd spoons. How do you actually make one? Hirsch says a straight knife, a hook knife, an axe, and a saw are all you need. So to carve a spoon, typically, and my favorite process, is to start with like a little limb of the tree and pick where the spoon lives in the tree. Hirsch says to then split the tree limb in half, avoiding the pith, which is the very center of the tree. Next, you draw the shape of the spoon on your wood, your spoon pattern. You really want to indicate where you want the bowl of your spoon to live, and then you cut little saw marks to release the wood on the sides of the handle, and then you split that material away. Refining, drying, and then oiling the spoon are the final steps. And then now I want to bring this down so it's nice and elegantly sloped. Hirsch says the hardest part is carving the rim of the bowl. Any mistake is very obvious because it's such a fine detail of the spoon. So it's really having really crisp, clean lines is what makes the spoon sparkle at the end. Hirsch's goal is to help make everyone's spoon sparkle. Yeah. For KFAI, I'm Angela Lundberg. So hopefully that split didn't travel through and do that little hairline fracture I was telling you about.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett and Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1538.